And we are live on a Sunday morning, 104.5 WOKV, Jacksonville's news and talk, and we are protecting military families with Chris Brochu. Chris, how are we doing this Sunday morning?
Casey, doing great. Voice is feeling a little hoarse. I don't know if it's staying up late and trying to grind out work or what, but feeling a little bit hoarse. Still me, though. Before we get into today's episode, as always, we got to talk about the second opinion. Second opinion's more important than ever. If you've got a rating from the VA that's less than 100%, VA told you that's all you're entitled to, your VSO says that's all you're going to get, or some other company says that these are all the benefits you have. If you're a military family and you want to make sure that you're not leaving benefits or other legal rights on the table, please feel free to give us a call. We're happy to review it. Our consultation is always free. We review everything, make sure that what you've been told is accurate. And if for some reason we find a benefit or a legal right that's on the table, then what we would do is tell you about it. If we decide to enter into a fee agreement, then at that point in time, we'd get a fee agreement in place. Obviously, no upfront cost or money for the military family. We advance all costs on behalf of military families and consumers, and there's no fee unless you win. Casey, do we have Daniel Elkins on the line?
We do.
Okay, great. I'm so excited. This morning we've got Daniel Elkins. He is with Independence Fund and a Green Beret. And without further ado, Daniel, can you hear me?
Yeah, absolutely. Good morning, guys.
Good morning. So before we get into it, we've got a lot of listeners here in Northeast Florida, and I don't know if we reach South Georgia, but Casey just gave me the thumbs up.
We're all over, man. You got no idea.
And then we post this all over social media and YouTube. So we should have a lot of military families to kind of spread the word about Independence Fund. But before we get there, Daniel, can you tell the listeners a bit about yourself, where you grew up, your service history, where you're at now, just some background information?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm originally from the Annapolis, Maryland area. So grew up right outside of D.C., kind of smack dab in the middle between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, Maryland. I enlisted a little bit later in life than most. I was in my late 20s when I really felt the call to serve. Grew up in a military family. My father was a Vietnam veteran, served honorably during the 70s, and just always had an affinity and a love for members of the military. But it didn't really come into the cards until I was a little later in life. And that's when I started to learn about the mission of the Special Forces, a.k.a. the Green Berets. And I enlisted with the intent to become a Green Beret, knowing full well that pipeline is extremely difficult and many don't make it. But I was fortunate enough that I made it through the pipeline, and it's been an amazing ride ever since. So I'm not on active duty. I am in the National Guard, and have the citizen soldier aspects of things. And when I'm not doing military related activities, I am working at the Independence Fund, where we are essentially enabling and assisting the most catastrophically wounded of the last 20 years. And we do that through numerous programs, including our track chair program, where we are able to assist wounded veterans, catastrophically wounded veterans that have, double, single, triple amputees with wheelchairs that actually allow them to go off-road, go into the woods, go to the beach, go hunting again, and just really committed to giving independence back to them.
That's phenomenal. Daniel, I just want to hear more about some of the adaptive equipment. Obviously, Labor Day weekend in Florida, we've got a lot of military families going to the beach. Can you talk about some of the adaptive equipment that allows a service member or veteran to get on the beach independently you know, what that equipment does and kind of looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, most people are unfamiliar with a track chair. So I think of a typical wheelchair, you know, it has, you know, very skinny or narrow wheels that would potentially get, you know, stuck in the sand in the same way like a bicycle tire would. However, what we do is we work with various manufacturers and create a custom-made wheelchair that has tank treads on it. So it's a treaded chair. So it can get traction in sand, in mud, in the woods, and we host events around the year, various places around the United States, where we actually go out in the woods. We do assisted shooting events, assisted retreats that involve, you know, either going to the beach or going hiking in the mountains, and it's just lovely to get this feedback from people. You know, I got one earlier this week. Basically, it was a thank you so much. You know, since the injury, I've been confined to basically my house and the area around my house. It's paved. Today is the first day I was able to go out into my yard. I saw a deer. I was able to explore my farm that I live on, and I'm truly grateful for the support of the Independence Fund. So it's just a total blessing.
It's almost like you're giving our wounded warriors their life back, right? I mean, they come, they leave, they come home critically injured, they recover, they've got great spirit, right? I mean, the trauma and tragedy that a lot of our military families go through is something that civilians like me could never understand. But I feel like once the service member or veteran, you know, moves on with their life, if they're unable to perform these activities that they used to love, right, outdoor activities, it kind of takes away part of their life. So you guys are giving back someone's life to them, right? I mean, you're giving them the ability to go back to do the things that they love to do.
Absolutely. And that is essentially the essence of the independence, right? You know, it's so powerful to be able to independently, you know, do the things that you want to do and have the freedom to do so. And that's what we do with, you know, thousands of members of the military from the last 20 years. And even those wounded, you know, in wars before the GWAT. And that's just the overwhelming, you know, emotion that I feel every day when I know I'm making a difference in people's lives in an impactful way.
Absolutely. And who thought of such a great idea? I mean, who sort of spearheaded Independence Fund? Do you know any, or can you tell us a little bit about their background?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I will say that I have been so impressed by Sarah Verado. She is the current CEO of the Independence Fund, and she has allowed, you know, her personal story essentially become, you know, a household story. I personally believe that no one in the United States that is not a veteran has done more for veterans single-handedly. And, you know, her story begins during the GWAT, where her husband was catastrophically wounded in Afghanistan. Her husband has had numerous surgeries, not well over 100, and is in 24/7 care, and she is a caretaker. And it's just being in that day to day, you know, and I personally have not had that experience. I have had friends that have needed to have 24/7 care due to their injuries. But Sarah Verado has lived this day in and day out, and continues to not only serve her husband in amazing ways, but has allowed her struggle to, motivate her to serve the warfighters of this community that have truly made the difference for the United States.
So did Sarah originally come up with some of these like prototypes, or how did those develop? Does she have an engineering background, or did she partner with someone? Did she think this up? I mean, this is such a creative, like, these are the ideas that we really need, right? Like, not the same plain Jane ideas, right? Of like,
yeah.
I don't know, like going and playing bingo, right? Like a really good idea.
I totally understand it. So Sarah does not have an engineering background, but I think it is a testament to the creativity and the genius, of Sarah, as well as of what the American people have and what we're capable of doing. When we really are motivated, and I think that's the culture at the Independence Fund, where, we're driven to think outside of the box. And, when we hear no, we figure out a way to get to yes, because we know it's so impactful for the lives of the service members that have been wounded.
Absolutely. And so just if you could tell the listeners, anybody that rewatches these episodes on YouTube, obviously we've become a much smaller world now that we have the internet and everybody can watch these videos from wherever. If we had someone living abroad or living in a, remote state, how do we get them in touch with Independence Fund if they're a wounded warrior that needs assistance with these adaptive devices?
Absolutely. So, the best place to go to is our website, theindependencefund.org. If there are people who are in need of assistance or, feel compelled to give, we highly suggest you go to our website. You can read about our various programs. There's a way for you to donate via our website, as well as reach out. We have multiple programs for, veterans who are in need, whether that might be financial assistance or medical assistance. Or perhaps you want to be a supporter or an ambassador of our organization. I know many of your listeners are in the business community. So we're always looking for partners, people that, feel compelled to potentially host one of our events, sponsor it. And we welcome that. We have, many ongoing connections with great businesses, some national and some on the local level. And we believe that everyone can do their part. And just because you personally, might not be involved day to day in the lives of veterans doesn't mean that you can't move the needle and assist them.
What does a local event look like? If somebody wanted to do a local event, in their state or their city, or somebody listening is a business owner that, wants to sponsor an event, what does an event look like for Independence Fund?
Yeah, so we have a wide range of events. So, we're very, very open to ideas that are brought to us to work collaboratively by, with, and through the community that feels compelled to support veterans. A few examples of, some of our programs would be our adaptive and supportive, shooting, where we are where we take veterans who are catastrophically wounded and we support them and bring in world-class instructors as well as provide the weapons that are necessary. We typically partner with, the shooting industry and have ammunition and other things like that donated, where we are then able to, get veterans and civilians together to have a day of shooting, fun competition, whether that be short or long range, shooting. And that's just one example of many that we do.
Absolutely. That's great. I want to transition here a little bit, but actually, before I do, one more time, Daniel, could you just give, I don't know if you have it handy. If not, we can get it at the other side of the break. If you have a telephone number, an email, or a physical address that you want to give a web address for Independence Fund. That way, if anybody's listening, and please, if you're listening and you know somebody that is a wounded warrior that needs adaptive equipment, please help us spread the word on this. But if you have any of that available, Daniel, please let the listeners know. If not, Casey can get it to him on the other side of the break.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I am, serve at the pleasure of the Independence Fund. So, you can go to our website, Again, that's the independencefund.org, and you can donate to us. You could also call me. My phone number is 301-741-0317, and I welcome you to put that in the show notes, whether that be on social media, on your website. And my email address is D, as in Daniel, dot Elkins at independencefund.org. So feel free to send me an email. You can leave me a voicemail, send me a text, or you can go to our website, and I will gladly engage any of your listeners that are interested in supporting or any of your listeners that are interested or in need of assistance.
Fantastic. And if anybody needs help or can't find that, give me a call, and we'll be happy to link you with the Independence Fund. On the other side of the break, we're going to talk about SOAA. That's another military nonprofit that Daniel's a part of. We're going to get into that. But before we go to break, we've got, you know, about 8 minutes here, 6 minutes here left. I really want to hear, I know we've got some younger listeners that rewatch these episodes that are interested in going into the military, specifically would love to be, you know, special forces like a Green Beret. Can you talk about your experience? Like, what would, if somebody was coming out of high school or college and wanted to go, you know, sort of the same route as what you've experienced, Daniel, what would they need to do to prepare themselves to become a Green Beret?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, and it's one that I actually get asked, you know, kind of frequently. So, you know, I think that, you know, a lot of people, when they think of the special operations community, they have this image, which is not inaccurate, but I think it's only, you know, part of the picture. And that is, it's an image of someone that's very, very physically fit, you know, and someone that's able to endure physical hardship. You know, people see movies with Navy SEALs or Green Berets, and that's typically how it's displayed. But, you know, I've found in the community that, you know, regardless of whatever your, you know, physical abilities are, you know, that can be grown, that can be taught, that, you know, with due diligence and training, you can rise to the standard and bring your physical fitness standard to the level that's necessary to get through the selection events. You know, some of the things that I think are often overlooked is the ability to engage and be a team player, which is super important. And it's something that we're also heavily graded on. It's like, how well do you work with others? How well can you communicate your ideas? You know, what is your leadership style? You know, so I always suggest people that are interested, you know, working in a team, whether that be a team sport or something that requires, you know, communication with others in order to, you know, get your point across and working in that regard. And I also think the other thing that a lot of people don't know about that's specific to Special Forces and the Green Beret is, you know, our ability to act as ambassadors, right? So whether that be speaking publicly, engaging with, you know, high-level officials around the world, or people who are in foreign militaries. You know, I found myself talking to ambassadors before, heads of state, as well as high-ranking, you know, officials that are equivalent to generals in other foreign militaries. So, you know, it's really important that that you learn or bring skills to the table that enable you to, you know, have conversations at high levels. And you don't need to be a subject matter expert in international policy or anything like that. All that training is provided for you. But, you know, if public speaking or leadership is something that's intimidating to you, you know, there are things that you can do, classes you can take, you know, groups you can join to help you kind of improve those areas. And those are always recommended.
You make such a valid point and describe it so succinctly for our listeners that are civilians. I mean, I know a lot of our military listeners, you know, are on the same page, but it is a good distinction because, you know, Green Berets are doing different things, right? You same caliber fighters as other special forces, but the mission might be different. I remember one of my favorite military books that I read was a book called The Guerrilla Factory. Have you ever read that one?
It's an amazing book.
That was one of my favorite books. I think it was Tony, maybe Schwalm. I can't remember. But it was such a fascinating book, and it talked about the mission of Green Berets is you're not only a warrior and a fighter, but your mission is to, you know, win the hearts and minds of the local community to help fight these bad actors, right? Is that accurate? I mean, I don't want to, you're the expert here.
And I think that's a succinct way of putting it. You know, the thing that drew me to the specific mission set of the Special Forces and the Green Berets is actually the motto, "De oppresso liber," and that means to free the oppressed, right? So it's working by, with, and through, you know, other individuals from other, you know, foreign nations to train, advise, and assist and equip them to fight on their own, you know, and that's something that is very unique to our mission set. And is this ability to, you know, understand culture and to work alongside in order to help them successfully defend, you know, their homeland, and, you know, as well as ours. And that's where I think that, you know, the Special Forces are significantly different than other communities within the Special Operations community as a whole. You know, for example, part of our training includes, you know, 6 months of language. You know, I never thought that I would learn another language and become fluent. But personally, I speak French, and it's because I was taught it during Special Operations Training Pipeline.
Wow. That's incredible. And most, or if not all Green Berets, they all have different languages that they're trained in, or is linguistics part of the training to become a Green Beret? Do you have to master that, at least one language? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you're given a language, a capability that you bring to a team. And most teams have multiple language capabilities. And there's a significant amount of individuals that speak more than one language, sometimes three or even four. So, you know, I speak French fluently. I do speak a little bit of Arabic as well as a little bit of Spanish.
Wow. Incredible. All right, on the other side of the – Casey's going to take us to the other side of the break, but we've got Daniel Elkins. We're going to be talking about SOAA on the other side of the break.
Yeah, it's easy as that. Stick with us. We'll be right back. A couple of commercials, but we get you right back to the conversation with Chris and Daniel right after this. The 7 o'clock hour, 104.5 WOKV, Jacksonville's news and talk, and we are live on a Sunday morning protecting military families with the one and only Chris Brochu of Brochu Law. A lot of good conversation in the first segment between Chris and Daniel. That will continue in just a second, but I do want to tell you, if you missed any of it, you can find it on Chris's website and his YouTube page, thanks to Justin at Nova Productions hooking you up with a video version of the show. You can see it and you can hear it as well. Find it on Chris's YouTube, which you believe is Brochu Law.
Yes.
And then your website.
That's what my social media guy tells me.
There we go. Just all you need to know is Brochu Law, and you'll find everything you need to know about Chris. By the way, if you want to give him a call, if you need his help, 904-201-1771. Or you can send him an email, case@brochulaw.com. For anything you could need his help with, especially if you need a second opinion, right, Chris?
Absolutely. And the second opinion that we covered in the first part of the show, same thing as always. If you believe that you have a legal right or military benefit on the table that you have a question about, or somebody told you that's all you're entitled to, give us a call. We're happy to review it. If there's something that we find and we agree to work together, we'd enter into a fee agreement. No upfront costs to military families. We advance all costs on behalf of military families. There's no fee unless you win. Again, that's for SGLI, VGLI, TSGLI, military lending, Camp Lejeune, VA disability, and we do some terrorism too, but those, I think the statute has run on those. Today we have Daniel Elkins with us on the second half of the show. We are going to be talking about Daniel's other nonprofit. This guy is an absolute machine. He started SOAA, which is the acronym for Special Operations Association of America. Daniel, welcome to the second half of the show. If you're still with us, tell us a little bit about SOAA.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, thank you so much for having me. It's always great to talk about veterans and the things that they're going through. You know, as you mentioned, I've been pretty busy. In addition to serving as a chief of staff of the Independence Fund, I am the founder of the Special Operations Association of America.
Wow.
It's a little bit newer. It's only been around for a few years now, but we've been able to do some pretty amazing things, you know, in the last couple of years, including some overseas programs for our allies around the world. The essence of the Special Operations Association of America is it's the only association in the United States that represents the interests of the special operations community in the way that you know, the VFW represents veterans, or American Legion represents veterans at large. Are, you know, in the way that any other veteran service organization has a specific niche of what they're trying to do. And we just noticed a huge gap. You know, in the last 10 years, the preponderance of effort has been conducted by members of our community. These amazing men and women do amazing stuff on and off the battlefield, in and out of uniform. And, you know, they are trained, myself included, to be quiet professionals, to just, you know, keep their head down and do the work, often with little or limited resources. And we believe that this community needs a voice as well.
Absolutely. And for our civilian listeners out there, like myself, well, you know, like myself, give us a rundown, if you could, about, so what type of special operators are we talking about, or who would sort of fit into that category under SOAA? If you could, just kind of by branch, I mean, PJs, Green Berets,
yeah.
who fits in there?
So, you know, within each service branch, you know, there are components or elements of the special operations community, and kind of working through them, you know, not in any sort of order of priority, but just by branch, right? So in the Army, you know, there's Green Berets, there's Army Rangers, and then there's, you know, a Tier 1 Joint Special Operations Unit called Delta Force. There's also the 160th. They're basically the air wing of the special operations community. And they're all in the Army. And in Navy, we have, you know, NSW, Navy Special Warfare. So you have, you know, Navy SEALs, their boat teams, as well as, you know, Navy EOD. And the Marine Corps, you have MARSOC, now Raiders. And then in the Air Force, you have the pararescue, or the PJs, as well as the CCTs, the combat controllers. I forgot to add in there, in the Navy, we have SEAL Team 6, our development group. And you have all the actual operators, but then you have the people who are, you know, directly supporting or enabling the operators. You know, no one wants to go to war, you know, and not have bullets or not get paid. So, you know, often,
point.
You know, yeah, often these units deploy, you know, with, you know, incredible men and women that help support or enable the warfighter to do the thing that we're trained to do. So, you know, we represent collectively that community at large.
That is one of the most interesting things that I've learned as an attorney that represents military families. I didn't realize how many military are attached with special forces, right? Like comms or different support that travel and deploy and do all of these things with special forces. I always figured it was just whoever the team was, right? That they sent over. So
yeah.
It really is quite fascinating.
Yeah, and it's a common misconception. And there are some environments where it is just the team on the ground, you know? But what goes into conducting that mission or that operation, you know, is a huge, you know, back-end support system that's equally as vital and important to the overall mission as the individuals on the ground. You know, everyone can't be the tip of the spear. And that's okay, but everyone does their part. And that's why we, you know, unite under the banner of one team, one fight.
Sure, sure thing. What are some of the issues that you've identified at SOAA that, you know, special operators and their families need most? I mean, what are some of the things that you all identified that you're trying to combat?
That's a great question. I think that, there are a few things that are really apparent to me that are direct needs within the special operations community. And, the one that comes to mind that we hear the most often, is the wounding, whether that be seen or occurs. A lot of people are familiar with the suicide pandemic in the veterans community. It's 19 to 22 a day. We've lost more people from suicide than we have lost on the battlefield over the last 20 years. And that's horrific. But the staggering statistic that I use is that, in the special operations community, suicide is 30% higher than the rest of the military. And that's significant. And that tells me that we have a lot of work to do. So, we advocate for alternative treatments, both to PTSD as well as TBI, tackling or engaging in neuroinflammation and some of the things that happen when people have traumatic blasts that can affect both people's mental health as well as their ability to actually function, from a physiological standpoint. So that's one of the main issues that we run into, and that would fall under our advocacy bucket, or if you will, one of the legs of a four-legged table. I really hope that we can get into some of those other legs as well, because that's where we move the needle in multi-domain, if you will.
Truly. Just incredible mission, because that is one of the areas that is probably in most need for our military families, is when our military, they come back from deployments or they get out of the military. It sometimes may feel like the military families are sort of left behind, because some of my clients have told me that, hey, I always felt like I was a part of this group, and then once I'm no longer an asset, I'm kind of discarded. So I think it's so important that not only do we identify some of these areas where we need to provide more support, but also some of these things that will, again, allow, like similar to the adaptive devices allow, it may not be, the same physical, mental, emotional state as before entering the military, but here are all of the programs. We're not going to leave you behind, and we're not going to forget about you, because, you see all of the money going overseas and going to all these places. And, sometimes I look at the Camp Lejeune bill failing and I'm just like, what is wrong with our country? Like, we've got all these military that are fighting and giving up their lives and giving up their freedoms. And we don't, if we don't support them here at home when they're out of the military, to me, that is equally as important as providing them the support that they need in combat.
Yeah, and I could not agree with you more. We have a firm belief that, if something happens in service to the United States, it should be the responsibility, of the government to bring you back to or assist you to, where you were prior to that incident, and or do the best that is humanly possible to enable you to have a normal life, that was potentially interrupted or changed due to your service. So, within the special operations community, more often than not, some of these issues happen and some of these things come up, and it may have come up during a classified mission, and that creates a whole other entire level of bureaucracy and or difficulty in getting the benefits that you need. As a lawyer union that helps with people that are engaged with the VA to increase their disability rating or even get a rating, all well how witness statements or, you know, the proof that you were on a mission and that's how you got wounded to show that it was service-connected is necessary. Can you imagine how difficult that is when the mission was, quote-unquote, never occurred or is classified and you're unable to actually, you know, openly talk about it? Then all of a sudden you have a situation where, you know, like you essentially are prevented or forbidden from, you know, communicating that something happened. But that doesn't change the fact that you got wounded or are struggling. So that is why we exist.
You're hitting the nail right on the head. TSGLI is what comes to mind when you talk about wounded, you know, especially combat injuries. And, you know, the military, we submit these claims, the military just kind of, you know, puts their hand up, right? So TSGLI, as you know, we're submitting those. If you are injured in the Navy, you know, we submit it to the Navy, Air Force, right? Et cetera. So it's difficult sometimes from my perspective to submit these claims and the military says, hey, we don't have enough information. And I'm like, well, you are the gatekeeper of the information, right? I mean, I've got my clients working with me. They've given me everything they have. I have obviously have my VA accreditation, so in most of these cases, I can get some personnel records and medical information from that. But, you know, sometimes it's a little bit frustrating because obviously the government has the information that they're saying they need more information about, right?
Yeah, no, and I mean, someone that is on the front lines and assisting like you are, right? Like, and, you know, you have the ability to get some of that information, but, you know, I would imagine that you currently don't have a top secret TSSCI.
No,
with,
sir.
You know, read into special access programs or, you know, have a polygraph, right? Like, you know, and that's the thing is, you know, some in DOD have these things, but more often than not, you know, the soldier or the sailor, the airman, the Marine that is in need of support, they're no longer in the military, right? And you know, there's not a lot of people in the VA that have these types of security clearances. So, you know, that alone presents a very unique problem set that, you know, just how was not being addressed. And, you know, as we've seen the increase in utilization of the special operations community, we've moved away since around 2014 to, you know, conventional forces just because of, you know, the nature of how warfare has changed. And now we're engaged in more asymmetric, irregular, and unconventional warfare. So what that's translated to is increased utilization of the special operations community. Now that the GWAT is over, the global war on terror, we're no longer in Afghanistan, we're not in Iraq in the way that we once were, but we still are engaged in national defense. You know, last night, special operations community were doing missions in over 80 countries around the world, you know,
wow.
Of which there are many that may be classified. And you know, these amazing men and women do these things in service to their nation. And then when they get out, they run into the bureaucracy of red tape that they have to navigate on their own. And, you know, when you're on a classified mission, it just makes it that much more difficult.
Truly incredible. And while all of us sleep in our nice, warm, comfy beds, we've got literally 80 missions, you said, going on while we sleep somewhere around the world. I mean, is that right?
No, it might be more.
Oh,
I'm
more.
Saying 80
okay.
Countries. 80
oh,
countries.
80 countries. Oh, my. Yeah, I haven't heard anything about Congress's declaration in a single one of those countries. So I would imagine a fair amount of those are kept under seal. I don't know if I'm right on that, but
yeah, and it might not necessarily always be like a mission in the way that some of your listeners might think, and you know, like, you know, where it's, you know, something like kinetic in nature. You know, we are operating around the world, working with other special operations units, conducting training, conducting assistance, you know, helping advise on issues in their countries, So it's a nonstop 24 hours a day, 7 days a week thing. And, these brave men and women that wear the uniform and do this, right, do it without any sort of hesitation. And that's one of the reasons why we're so motivated to assist them.
And when they deploy and do not have hesitation, I think part of that, or at least maybe a small fraction, is, hey, if God forbid something goes south, I know that my country's got my back, right? I mean,
100%.
Is that right? It's not my experience. I want to ask you, but at least in terms of, as an American, I would think that that would be going through their head.
Yeah, no, that you've nailed it, like the hammer on the head of the nail, for sure. Can you imagine the stress that you would be under if, you were engaged in combat or engaged in service to this nation, overseas, and there are issues with your pay to your family or your family's health care? And those types of things, that belief, that trust in the federal government, that like if something does go wrong, there is this assistance, that is vitally important to our national security. And that's why it's vitally important for us to continue to work with the VA. They don't always get it right, but they are there and they're well-intentioned. And, I know that there's a lot of consternation sometimes within the community for people trying to receive the care that they deserve and are unable to do so. But at the same time, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And we appreciate the men and women in the VA and the work that they do. But they often have difficulty in their own right. And that's where we come in and we can help navigate some of that red tape and through relationships and our advocacy efforts, get to yes and get the service members the care that they need.
No doubt about that. Before we get on to any more questions or get cut short, I want to make sure that we have an opportunity for you to get SOAA's contact information out there, website, where if somebody wants to give a donation, provide support, if somebody wants to tell their friend that was a special operator about SOAA, where would they go to do that?
Yeah, we encourage anyone from the special operations community to join. We don't charge membership fees or dues. Our motto is you've already paid enough. You don't need to pay for this.
It's a really good motto.
It's free to sign up. So you can go to www.soaa.org or soa.org. There's a way for you to join as well as a way for you to donate. I think that, in addition to actually assisting and serving the special operations community, one of the other things that we do is very, very unique to this association specifically, is our engagement in national security strategy and advisement, right? So you have fewer members of Congress and political appointed officials that have military background now than in the history of our republic. And these politically appointed officials, they often don't have the experience and or the knowledge base that we bring to the table. So what we do is we bring operators and people from the intelligence community that have dirt under their fingernails, that have been in these areas, often recently, and elevate their voice to the highest levels of government to help, engage and strategize so they can make better decisions. Often in D.C., there are think tanks that, produce ideas. But they lack what we call that last mile ability, which is to get into classified spaces and have an open discussion on, options, right? So our members, and including the people on the staff, have security clearances and, are subject matter experts in their own regard on these issues, whether that be Afghanistan or Ukraine or Taiwan. So we're really able to have open conversations in classified spaces in order to help advise on what's going on.
All super, super important and fascinating information from obviously issues plaguing the globe. Before we cut to the end of the show, I want to leave you. We'll have about 30 seconds. one of the most interesting things about our conversation the other day was how you worked on Capitol Hill to create legislation for our military families. What is it that you're working on now, and what do our military families need? Like, what is plaguing them the most? That what's our next mission, right? I mean, we got Camp Lejeune, we got burn pits. What's next? What's the next front line?
Yeah, you know, and I think this, transcends both Special Operations Association of America as well as the Independence Fund and other organizations that serve the military community. You know, we have to figure out a way to address this mental health crisis that we're seeing within the United States and the veteran population, right? And, you know, for the last 20 years, we've tried to do it in a very conventional way, i.e., you know, therapies that include, you know, drug treatments, SSRIs, and things of that nature. And it's just, it's the facts. It's not working. And it's time for us to explore alternative treatments to PTSD, as well as alternative treatments to treating things like TBI and neuroinflammation. You know, a few examples of those, are things like psychedelics, or neuroinflammation treatments. You know, we're looking at the endocrine system to treat, these symptoms. And, you know, a lot of times people are get a little consternation about these things, you know, and, oh, you know, you want to use, you know, party drugs or things of that nature. And to which I reply, well, look, the evidence is overwhelming. You know, when we have military families that are self-paying for their spouses to, you know, go down to South America to, you know, go through a treatment, not a party, but to go through a treatment over, you know, 3 or 4 days, and they come back, and, you know, we're getting letters that, you know, like, you know, my husband or my wife, his life's changed. I didn't think it was possible. It seems like they've gone through 20 years of therapy in 4 days. They are a changed person. You know, I think to me, the writing's on the wall. We need to research this, under the care of medical providers, but it's time for us to start saying, okay, these things that we were resistant to, we might want to look into moving forward.
No doubt about that. Daniel Elkins, thank you so much for being on the show today. We had such a great time chatting with you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us, and we look forward to continuing to fight the fight.
Certainly.
We'll
Thanks,
do it
Casey.
Again next week.